Our scripture reading this morning comes from the Gospel of John, chapter 4. We're going to be reading parts of the story of the woman at the well. We're going to begin in verse 7 and read through verse 19, and then we're going to jump down and finish up in verses 27 through 29. A Samaritan woman came to draw water, and Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." His disciples had gone to the city to buy food, and the Samaritan woman said to him, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask a drink of me, a woman of Samaria?" Jews do not share things in common with Samaritans. Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." The woman said to him, "Sir, you have no bucket, and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our ancestor Jacob, who gave us the well and with his sons and his flocks drank from it?" Jesus said to her, "Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. But those who drink the water that I will give them will never be thirsty. The water that I will give will well up in them a spring of water gushing up to eternal life." And the woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I may never be thirsty or have to keep coming here to draw water." Jesus said to her, "Go, call your husband and come back." The woman answered him, "I have no husband." Jesus said to her, "You are right in saying, 'I have no husband,' for you have had five husbands, and the one you have now is not your husband. What you've said is true." The woman said to him, "Sir, I see that you're a prophet." Just then his disciples came. They were astonished that he was speaking with a woman. But no one said, "What do you want?" or "Why are you speaking with her?" Then the woman left. She left her water jar and went back to the city. And she said to the people, "Come and see a man who told me everything I have ever done. He cannot be the Messiah, can he?" The word of God for the people of God. Thanks, man. For the last several weeks, you may be seated. We've been having a conversation of moving beyond Band-Aids. And what we mean with that is moving beyond the sort of emotional Band-Aids that we put on our lives to kind of cover up really deep wounds that we've suffered, whether in our souls or our spirits. And yet, we sort of just put an emotional Band-Aid on them. We put our fake smile, and we just kind of continue on as if everything's okay. And we just sort of move past really realizing that some of these wounds, if we don't talk about them, if we don't find help for them, they continue to fester. They continue to hurt until we get to a point to where it feels like we can't hold our lives together at all. And so we've been talking about shame. We've been talking about blame. And so today, we sort of come to a point in our story arc where we talk about hopelessness. And the point of where hopelessness comes to where we feel like we can't do it any longer, and we're going to talk about suicide. So my friend here, Steve Austin, is a Amazon best-selling author in several categories for a couple books that he's written. And he's going to be joining us kind of in our talk today. Some of his books that he's written is From Pastor to the Psych Ward, Self-Care for the Wounded Soul, and he's going to be releasing his third book here in just several weeks, and we're actually trying to organize having a launch party for that book here in Restore, Catching Your Breath. And so he is a phenomenal author when it comes to this topic. He's a nationally renowned speaker and comes from right here in Alabaster, attended Thompson High School, so he's kind of the prophet coming home.
So y'all better run.
Yeah, no pressure. But this all kind of started with a conversation over some very, very public figures sort of across our headlines. Anthony Bourdain, when Anthony Bourdain committed suicide, and that kind of started a conversation of why don't we talk about suicide in church? And so we decided, let's talk about suicide in church. And what would it look like to devote an entire Sunday to self-care and suicide? And from that conversation, we said, man, what would it look like to do 5 weeks on self-care and suicide? And so I want to welcome my good friend Steve Austin. Give him a hand.
Thank you.
I just want to kind of start off in saying, why does this matter? Why do we need to talk about this?
I got to welcome my good friend Sue Graham. So my friend Sue is interpreting for us, and I work for Sue and have worked for Sue for about 10 years, but she's one of my dearest friends. So I want to say thank you for interpreting the service. So, suicide, why does it matter? Why are we having this conversation from the pulpit on a Sunday morning? Yeah, you're right. Anthony Bourdain, I was shocked with Robin Williams. A lot of you probably were too. And then, as terrible as those are, you look at this pastor last week from Chino, California, a pastor, a husband, a father of 3 boys, and he died by suicide last Sunday. There's also in the news last week a nine-year-old little boy who died by suicide. So I think the question is, why are we not talking about it? Why have we not been talking about it? We have to start talking about it today, and don't let this just be one conversation. Let this be one conversation of many. We have to keep this conversation going. I think the answer to why we haven't talked about it is there's, for some reason, this misunderstanding that when you go down to the altar, when you're a kid or a teenager or an adult, whenever, you go down to the altar, you pray the sinner's prayer, you ask Jesus to come in your heart, and everything's better. It's all good now. And while that is true for your eternal salvation, you're still a human being living in a human body, having a human experience. And as humans, sometimes we have really difficult experiences, very hard seasons, sometimes very difficult lives. And so I think that we have to have this conversation because we need a reminder that we're humans, that you don't just pick up that shield of faith and hide behind it forever and think God's going to just make you immune to suffering. It's just not true. And it's part of my story as well.
Yeah. I think sometimes when we talk about suicide and faith, we think about church being a safe place, somewhere where we can come, we can be very honest. We deal with some of our harder and our darkest moments in faith and churches. Yet at the same time, in my experience, sort of being raised in the church and in ministry, for me, church is the hardest place where I can be myself, where I can be honest. And the other side of that is sometimes we fear that it's the place we're going to be judged the most.
Sure. Yeah. You think about the struggles, the insecurities, the fears, the worry, the stress that you individually deal with, and then multiply it by 300. And that's what this guy deals with every day, every week. And we expect our pastors to do that well, to do it with a smile all the time, to never have a bad day, to never need help. Every pastor ever needs to be in therapy. Every pastor should go and sit on the couch at the counselor's office. It would make them a better pastor. Not only would it make them a better pastor, a better husband or a better wife, a better parent, we probably should all be in counseling, truth be told. But especially our pastors, we expect somehow that they've got this extra portion of God and they're really immune. And that's just not true. This is a regular guy, big and tall and strong as he might be, just a regular guy with regular struggles just like the rest of us, and a calling from God, but a job. This is a job, and there's a human being behind that. And so I think that we have to give our pastors just as much grace as we expect them to give us, patience and kindness and understanding and all of those things. Pastoring is not an easy role.
I think sometimes what I've noticed in churches where I've served and in churches where I grew up as a member as well is sometimes there's this this paralysis. Whether it's something that I'm dealing with, if I'm dealing with my depression in a really hard way, it's always been hard to feel like I could really talk about that in church. Because when I did talk about that, sometimes the person that felt the safest, they felt unqualified. They felt like maybe they were afraid they were going to say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing. So talk a little bit about sort of what you see in churches with the people that are not pastors, sort of what we deal with in being open with each other and sort of this paralysis of not being an expert.
Yeah. The truth is that's a lie. We're all experts. We're all experts at being human. However long you've been here, 10 years, 50 years, you're an expert at being you and at being a human. And so one of the most basic things we do as humans is to communicate. I talk, you listen. You talk, I listen. And so maybe you don't have, you know, the letters behind your name. You're not a counselor, a therapist, a mental health professional. Maybe you don't have a diagnosis, depression, anxiety, PTSD. Maybe you don't really get it. But you do have a heart in here, and God has called us to love our neighbor, period. He didn't say love the easy ones. He didn't say love the ones that seem to mostly have it all together. He just said love, the greatest commandment, right? And so if you're not an expert, what can you do? Listen. Ask somebody, hey, how are you doing? And when you don't get the, oh, I'm blessed thing we say when we walk by, when they actually say, you know, I'm having a rough day. I'm having a rough week. Man, my marriage is really difficult right now. Stop and ask more. Ask another question. Follow up. What can I do? Do you want to talk about it? Are you okay? Dig a little deeper. Not to be nosy, not so you can go gossip, but so that you can be a safe person. I think that the biggest thing that we can do, whether it's in church or at the kitchen table at home or in our classrooms or a place of business, is to be a safe person who says, it's okay to not be okay. You can absolutely love Jesus with all your heart and unfortunately sometimes want to die. And that's a really uncomfortable thing to hear from up here. I know we go, well, you're not supposed to say that. Yeah, we do need to say that. There's this misunderstanding that you can be Christian or you can be crazy, which is a terrible word that you should never use, but there's this idea that you can be one or the other, that you can't be a Christian and struggle. But the truth is I have to take a little white pill every day because my brain is not quite wired like everybody else's. And it makes me a better person. It doesn't make me a weak person. It helps me show up more for my wife, for my kids, to be a better father and husband, to be a better contributor to whatever community I'm in. And so we've got to strip the fear, the shame, the guilt, the stigma. We've got to strip all of that away and say, you know what? Here's what I think about. Y'all remember, you probably don't have one of these phones anymore, but growing up, Mom had the phone that hung on the wall, and it had that curly Q cord on it, kind of like a pig's tail. And you remember how it would get all tangled up? You'd go to get the phone, and you'd have to pull it apart because you want to go around the corner and talk to your girlfriend so your mom wouldn't hear or something. I think that's life. We're all wound up and twisted up, and we're just trying to unwind a little bit. We're all trying to tell the truth. And sometimes the truth is that we're just not okay.
Yeah. So your story, I think, has been a really powerful one as I've kind of got to know you over the last couple months and sort of your struggle and your journey with suicide and sort of your journey of reestablishing relationships and trust and even coming back home and kind of speaking here today and coming back to Alabaster. So talk a little bit, if you can, about your story and how that meant as somebody in ministry, as a husband, as a father, and sort of your journey through this topic.
Yeah, this is super scary, okay? So, yeah, I grew up here. I've been here basically all my life, and there's familiar faces all the way around. And so it's much easier to write a book and somebody gets it and we don't have a conversation about it. Or write a blog and somebody out of state or out of the country reads it. That's easy. I can do that all day long. I've been on the stage all my life. Sang my first solo in the church at 5. So doing this, being up here, is easy. But doing this here, right here specifically in Alabaster, where I see friends that I've known for years, that's really uncomfortable. When you realize that I was in my suicide attempt was 6 years ago this month. I was an interpreter. I was a youth pastor at the same time. And because my mental illness was not being treated, because I had been through some really terrible trauma when I was a little bitty boy, and because I was ashamed of all of that and didn't know I had permission to ask for help, I was not living my best life. I made some poor decisions and hurt some people. And in the process of all that, lost my job as an interpreter, lost my job as a youth pastor, and saw no hope. You talk about hopelessness when you... Let's just be real. When you believe the lie of the American male, that you got to pull yourself up by your bootstraps, that your identity is found in what you do, not in who you are, and you lose your job, and you've got a wife at home, and a little one-year-old baby, and you know that human nature is to believe the very worst. When we hear something bad has happened, what we don't know, we fill in the blanks with all these terrible what-ifs and assumptions. And so when you look at the suicidal person, if you look at the studies, it's usually the 2 weeks that they've just come through or the 2 weeks that they think they're about to go through that makes them want to die. It's, I've just lived through the worst 2 weeks of my life and I can't do this another day. Or, boy, I've just lived through a really terrible event, and the next 2 weeks are unthinkable, and I can't possibly do that. And they want to die, and they try to die, or they do die. And so that's what it was for me. I said, I can't possibly do this. I have no job. I have no way to support my family. All these people are talking, and I feel like maybe people are gossiping and thinking the worst and don't believe me and wouldn't care if they knew the whole story. I get Jonah feeling like he's in the belly of a whale in the bottom of the ocean and there's no light and it's pitch black and you think, this is the worst thing ever. And so, yeah, I tried to die by suicide 6 years ago this month, the day before my little boy turned a year old. I think that we do a really good job in churches of talking about what happens after you die. We talk about heaven or hell. Like it's a place we're going to go after we die. And I'm not trying to get into some wacky theology, but I think that we can be so focused on what happens after we're not here anymore that we forget that there are people living in a living hell right now, sitting in the pew next to us, preaching from the behind the pulpit. And if we don't create a safe space, if this isn't the most inviting, welcoming, safe place for anybody, no matter their experience, no matter their lifestyle, if anybody couldn't show up at that door and feel safe in here, we're doing something wrong. So that's why we're having this conversation.
So in kind of our conversations, the scripture that we read this morning, the woman at the well, that story's got a lot of power for you. And the way that you've seen the gospel kind of come through that story and the way that you've seen that lived in your life. Talk a little bit about the woman at the well.
Yeah, let's recap it. So middle of the day, noontime. Just picture noontime in Alabama in September or August. It's hot. Sweating. You've been working outside or you've been walking. Your car broke down, you know, and you got to walk home. Hot, sweaty, tired, thirsty. And there's a well. Thank goodness. I need something to drink. Well, there's a Samaritan woman sitting there. And Jews and Samaritans didn't mix. It would have, you know, sort of been like separate water fountains in the 50s. We don't have anything to do with one another. This is not okay. This is not culturally accepted. And Jesus didn't care. He was thirsty, and here's a woman sitting at a well who could give him something to drink. Now, this was not just any woman. This woman had been with 5 different men, and the one she was with at the time was not her own. Everybody knew about this lady. She'd made some really bad life decisions, and I think probably because she was in despair, probably because she was overwhelmed, probably because she was not healthy. And so she's trying to fill a void the only way that she knew how to feel loved, accepted, approved. And Jesus comes up and they start having this conversation, this Jewish rabbi. And he reads her mail. We think, you know, we sort of imagine Jesus kind of pulling out the crystal ball and he's reading her mind. But I just don't think that's true. I think they all knew her story. So when he says, yeah, you've been with 5 men and the one you're with now is not your own, she turns in kind of this smart aleck way and says, oh, you must be a prophet. You're not telling me anything that they don't all know. Why do you think I'm here at noon in the middle of the day when it's hot rather than going to the well in the morning with the rest of the women from town when it's much cooler? She didn't want to be around them. They were all talking about her. And I think she wasn't scared of what they knew, because we all make mistakes. Everybody screws up. We all drop the ball. We all blow it, right? It's just human nature. But I don't think it's what they knew about her that bothered her. I think it's what they didn't know. It's how they filled in the blanks. It's the assumptions they made. It's the stories they made up among themselves about really just how terrible this lady was. And so I think the amazing thing about this story, it's not the story where Jesus tells the man, go dip in the river 7 times and you'll be healed. It's not Jesus putting mud on somebody's eyes and then being able to see. There wasn't some miraculous snapping of the fingers and suddenly everything's better. Jesus changed this woman's life by having a conversation with her. God worked in her life, transformed her life in the most ordinary of ways. 2 people sitting down, having a glass of water, and having a conversation. And the way that I connect with it so much is, here's this person who is covered in piles of shame. And Jesus looks her in the eyes. He doesn't avoid her. He doesn't act like she's not there. He doesn't go on to the next well. He sits down and has a conversation. And he empowers her to own her story for probably the first time. Her story had owned her for years. She'd really messed up along the way. And Jesus empowers her to own her story. And so she's so blown away by this wild-eyed rabbi who talks to her that she goes running back into town. She's so excited, she leaves her jug of water at the well and goes running back into town. Come meet a man who tells me everything I've ever done. Could he be the Messiah? And I think it brings us back to right here, where we are, getting ready to participate in communion, looking at communion as this level playing field, where we're all equal, where grace comes in, right? The grace of God comes in and says, you're all the same. You're all the same in my eyes. You're all equally loved in my eyes. There's nothing you could do. There's nothing you've ever been through that will cause me to turn away. And we are all common. It's common union. We're all together at this table. It's the most beautiful thing. So that's what continues to save me. People say, you know, what's the last 6 years been like? It's been doing this. It's been having really uncomfortable conversations, not always from a stage, but going into your boss's office and crying your eyes out because you can't do today. I just can't human today. Or having a wife who will let you not be okay, who doesn't expect you to always be the tough guy, who's always got it together. It's having honest conversations with people who hold your best interest at heart, who give you understanding and compassion no matter what. That's what saves people's lives.
Yeah. And when we talk about community, the power that comes from being part of a community where there is no right thing to say, to make somebody's life all of a sudden better, and understanding that there's nothing we're going to say in a moment that's going to fix anything, and being comfortable with that, being able to speak into that. One of the things that I thought was really powerful in our conversation about community is this really affects us here. This isn't just, you know, something's happened in California, something's happened in New York, it's happening right here in Alabama too.
Yeah. You look at the statistics. So the CDC just came out with the latest suicide statistics. And I think it's easy for us to think, you know, we're in Alabama. This is God's country. There's a church on every corner and everybody's pretty good. Yeah, not so much. The suicide rate from 1999 to 2016 has increased 21.9% in Alabama. So it's happening right here. I first heard the word suicide when I was in seventh grade, and a little boy who was in sixth grade, who lived right across the street, right there in Siluria, hung himself in his closet. And 2 years later, I heard suicide again because my mom's sister died by suicide. So it's not just celebrities. It's not just, you know, people in New York or California. It's people right here in the pew next to us. It's our neighbors. It's our children. It's, you know, it's people that we work with every day, and we have no idea the burdens that people are carrying. And it's why kindness and compassion matter so much. It's why the greatest commandment is love.
And that we don't necessarily fix somebody with kindness or compassion, but we start a conversation, we care about people.
Yeah.
And that allows us to be able to take them to somebody who really can.
That's exactly right. Yeah, you take them to your pastor, and you hope that every church has a referral network, and the pastor is a starting point, and they're going to say, let me get you to Ashley C. Davis because she's a counselor, and she's a mental health professional, and she can help. Let me get you somewhere to somebody who is trained to help you. I'll drive you there. I won't leave you alone if you're in mental health crisis. I'll stick with you until we've got you the help that you need. I'm a safe person. That's what everybody ought to put on their Facebook, on their Twitter, whatever. I am a safe person. That ought to be everybody's status today, because that's what people need to know, is that no matter what's going on in my life, I can come to you and I can tell you, and you won't turn me away, but you will be present with me on my very worst day. That's fulfilling the call of Christ. If God is a very present help in time of need, and God is living inside of us, then we should be a very present help in time of need.
I don't want to wrap up and kind of begin moving towards our celebration of communion and what it means to live in community. So what's kind of your last wrap-up? What's kind of the last word you'd like to kind of leave with us?
Oh, man. you know what? I'll leave you with a quote by Paul Young. Paul Young wrote the book several years ago, The Shack. Many of you have probably read, whether you would admit it in church or not. But he wrote this book, The Shack, and one of my favorite quotes that he says is this: to the extent that you live in fear, that is the extent to which you don't know that you are loved. So if God is love, and perfect love casts out fear, we have to know that at the core of our being, like down in our very DNA, is the love of God. And there's nothing, height or depth, there's nothing, future or past or right now, there's nothing that can separate us from the love of God. And so when we know that, we can be even more vulnerable. We can tell our stories rather than allowing our stories to own us and cause us to cower and hide. And, you know, the final thing I would say is go to counseling. Go to therapy. Make the phone call. Do it. It'll change your life. Saved my life. Saved my marriage. Jesus can save your soul, and counseling can save your life.